a youth rally there. Banner Elk, North Carolina is way up in the mountains. And there's a ski slope that comes straight down, and the Banner Elk Church of Christ sits almost at the base of that. You could stand in front of their building and look up behind it, and the ski slope just goes up there. It's an amazing place. And because they'd invited us to come, they told us that we could come and do a little skiing a little early. So we went over a little early and spent some time skiing, and had gone through the youth rally on Friday evening and Saturday. And Saturday evening and Saturday night, some of us were sitting around, and we thought, you know what? Skiing down that ski slope was fun, but I wonder what it'd be like to sled down it. And so we kind of got to talking about it and thinking about it a little bit. And the guy that we were staying with owned a ski shop. And so he had some sleds at his place. And they weren't like the old with the metal. These were kind of long, and they were deep, and they were plastic, and they were kind of like small troughs or tubs. So we decided that we were going to sneak out in the middle of the night, and we were going to go sledding down this ski slope. So we got these big sleds. And we tied them to our arms because we figured that if we fell off of them, they'd go flying down without us. And we took two Freed Artemann vans. We took one, and we parked it at the bottom of the ski slope, and we drove to the top, and we parked in a condominium area up there, and we snuck through the woods into the ski slope area, and we started at the Black Diamond. Before I go any further, those of you at work at Freed Artemann, can I get in trouble for this now, what I'm about to tell you? Just give me a yes or a no. I just need to know. Because it was a little illegal. Maybe not a whole lot illegal, but a little bit. And we were at the top of this Black Diamond, and we were a mile and a quarter high. It was a long way down. And we were sitting there. And the way it had worked was during the day, everybody had been skiing, and they had been patting down the snow from being skied on. And then when the sun went down, the temperature got real low, and all that was packed down got hard like ice, and they were putting fresh powder on top of it. So it was so slick, you could barely stand up. And there were about five of us up there, and we sang "We Shall Assemble on the Mountain" because we felt that was appropriate. And we said a prayer. I'm not sure that works for things that are slightly illegal, but we prayed for safety anyway. And you could see for about 75 yards down there, and then it just dropped. We had skied it, so we knew something was there, but we weren't exactly sure what. And so we got in our sleds, and we let go. And we went off the edge of that, and we turned and went straight down this area. And as we're looking down, we all realize there's a big tree area right in front of us. And the ski slope kind of went down and turned this way. And we didn't know that when we got started, so we're heading over top of this thing, and we're kind of like a luge, you know? We're kind of looking down between our feet while we're laying on our backs, and we're coming close to this. In order to stop, we're flying down through there. We had to jump off. We had to roll off the thing. And so we're going feet first, so we roll off. We had to dig our feet in, dig our knees in, dig our elbows, dig our fingers, dig our nose, anything we could in to stop before we ran into all these trees. And so we've got feet, knees, elbows dug in. The sleds are kind of coming behind us, and we all managed to stop. And right there at that area was a sign. It was a big pole, a little bitty sign. The sign said, "Beware of hole." Well, we didn't think anything about it. We scooted over down through that area, and here we went right back down through, and we finished up our little sledding expedition. Well, it was a blast. So we had to do it again, but we had a problem because we had a Freed Artemann van at the bottom and a Freed Artemann van at the top. So we had to go get into this van, drive back up to the top, bring both of them back down, and then drive one back up so that we would have one at the top, you know, to get us. So we get it down, and we decide, here we go. We assembled on the mountain again, said our prayer again because it worked the first time, and here we go, taking off. Well, I decided that I was going to hang on just a little longer this time. I mean, I was going to get just a little more speed because it was a pretty good shot down through there. And I hung on just a little bit longer, and finally I bailed. I jumped out of the thing. And I started digging my feet in, digging my elbows, trying to stop as I'm going down through there, but I wasn't stopping. One of my other buddies named Jay was already down there, and he saw me come flying down through there and saw me heading towards this sign that said, "Beware of the hole." And so as I go flying past him, he dives for me and grabs my arm, and our fingers just slip off. I reached for a tree limb and just ripped all the pine needles off of it. And then there is this big pole that says, "Beware of the hole." And I reach out to grab it, and as I go by, it just goes, "Dong!" And here I go into the hole. Well, the first time through, it wasn't that big of a deal. We were able to stop. There was a little bitty sign. This second time, it became a lot bigger deal because I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know what was coming. There was a little sign that said, "Beware of the hole." This could have been a big hole. This could have been a small hole. I don't know anything about what I'm getting myself into here. I don't know what to expect. And all of a sudden, my unexpected situation got worse because I fell in the hole. And as I'm going in the hole, I don't know why it's there. I don't know if it's there because there's rushing water going under the ice. I don't know if it's there. I don't know how deep it is. I don't know anything. And so just as I go off the edge into this hole, I just turn around and hold my breath. I literally thought I was going to die. And I go flying, and I land in the bottom of this hole. The sled goes slamming all around me, and there's this little bitty puddle of water right between my feet that I did not produce, okay? But there was a little bitty, little thing of water right there. But I was about 8 feet down. They had to lean over the side and help me climb up out of that thing. And I was a little rattled, but we still had about a mile to go, so we scooted over and went on down through there. Well, I'll be honest with you, something unexpected happened, and it became a big deal in a hurry. It became a real big deal, and luckily I wasn't hurt. Nobody got hurt. We actually went back the next year and did it again. Sorry, Fried Hardeman people. We did it again. We had a blast. I'd probably go do it again. It was a lot of fun. By the way, sledding is a whole lot more fun than skiing, just to let you know. It is a whole lot more fun. They ought to take those ski slopes and give everybody a sled. A little more dangerous, but it's a whole lot more fun. You know, the thing about unexpected things are you just don't know what's coming. You can prepare for certain things. You can get ready for certain things. You can study certain things. You can think through certain things. But there are some things that you just can't can't know what's coming. And what's interesting about life is that's the way it is. There are so many unexpected things that come at us. There are so many unexpected things that come our way, so many things that we didn't plan on, that we didn't bank on, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Sometimes there are terrible things that happen. There are deaths, or there are diseases, or there are car accidents, or there are tragedies, and we didn't expect them. And these small things that we didn't even see coming alter our lives. And then there are good things that happen. You get a letter from Fried Hardeman that says that they're going to give you a free ride. That would be completely unexpected, wouldn't it? Nobody expects to see that letter coming. You know, you get some information that's great. And it changes what's happening. And the unexpected has a huge outcome. And the thing about it is, God is that way. We don't see the future. We don't know how providence works. We don't know how God is working things in our lives. We just know that if we do the best we can do, whatever the unexpected is, we can hope for the best outcome. All things work together to good for those who love the Lord. You continue on that passage. The idea is that when unexpected things happen, if we're faithful, we can deal with them. I want you to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. There's an interesting chapter here. As he starts off, there's really two divisions, a natural division in the book of 1 Corinthians. He received a letter from Chloe's household, and he obviously received one from a man named Stephanus' household. One of those letters told him that there was some division in the church. One of those letters apparently had a list of questions that the church had. And so he's just talking to them about the division that's in the church in the first part of this book. And then he changes gears and goes to what I call the now concerning passages of this book, where he's answering their questions because there were some problems. So they had division, and then they got a letter about what the division was about, and he began to answer those. Well, Paul's relationship with the Corinthian church was interesting. He spent 18 months with them, but when he got there, he had just gone through a terrible situation. You go to Acts chapter 17, and you see where he was in Thessalonica. And he was in Thessalonica for somewhere between 3 and 6 weeks. He wasn't there very long, but he established a church. He reasoned in the synagogue for three Sabbaths. So we know he was there for a while. And he had converted some folks. And he had to leave Thessalonica because there was a mob that chased him out of a man named Jason's household. And he went about 50 miles southeast to a smaller town called Berea. Now, those in Berea were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica. They received what he said, and they searched the scriptures to see if what he was saying was so. But while he was there having such great success with his smaller church in a smaller area, those folks in Thessalonica said, hey, he's down in Berea. And he's causing problems down there too. So they leave Thessalonica and come after him in Berea and chase him out. He goes down into Athens, and he stands up on top of Mars Hill. And he addresses the Areopagus, the Areopagus, however you want to say that. And I've been there. It's a rock about the size of this building. They climb up on top of it, and they talk about all kinds of philosophical things. And they love to hear about new religions. And so Paul, with his wisdom, took opportunity to explain to them about the God that they didn't know, the unknown God. But some listened to him and some didn't. And it was tough, and it was a rough situation. And he flees from there and has to end up over. He goes across the sea into Corinth. And he stays in Corinth for 18 months. And that was the place where he got to rest. That was the place where he got to go in, and the work went well. They listened to him. But that didn't go so well either, because he ends up standing before the judgment seat. It's a big raised area right off the downtown. From the judgment seat, you can see the sea, and you can also see the plains, and you can see everything that's downtown. And they stood up there, and they would bring whoever was problematic before them. There was a big pole, and they would stand them right in front of that pole, and they would bring the case against them out in the public. Paul stood right there. And he ended up having to leave. And so when he writes back to the Corinthians, he's upset for them. He writes to the Galatians, and he's upset at them. You've turned so quickly from the gospel. But he writes back to the Corinthians because of his relationship with them. He's upset for them because he knows that they've got some division. And he even says here in verse 12, now I say this, that each of you says, I'm of Paul, or I'm of Apollos, or I'm of Cephas, or I'm of Christ. There are at least four divisions in this church. And he goes on to say that, you know, I didn't come to baptize you, and I'm glad I didn't, because I don't want you to think that because you were baptized with me that your baptism is more important than somebody else's. He's not diminishing baptism when he says that, but he's diminishing his reputation because it was all for Christ anyway. And look what he says in verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. And so he says, it wasn't with my wisdom. It wasn't with my wisdom that I brought you the message of Christ. It was the message of Christ that was helpful to you. And so the next section is a little where he compares the wisdom of God to the wisdom of men. And he's very straightforward. He's almost trying to antagonize them a little bit. You got to understand that whole area of Greece just prided themselves on philosophy and being smarter than everybody else and knowing more than everybody else. And so they would have tried to dismiss Paul as an ignorant person. And so in this passage, he accepts that. He accepts that, and he doesn't try to get on the level with the philosophers, but he puts Jesus on their level. And if you look at what he says in verse 18, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's a power of God. The word message here is the same word, logos, that is in John chapter 1 when John introduces Jesus, the Word. And so the idea was it wasn't just a word, just like this is translated. It was the message of Jesus. The message of Jesus is I love you more than I love myself. That's the message that God was giving us when he sent Jesus. Because he sent himself to live among us and to die. That's the message that he was trying to get. And that's foreign to people. And that's hard for people to understand, especially people who feel feel like they're better than other people or feel like they have a better handle. That a God so high and lofty would then turn around and lower himself to be like one of us, that's not much of a God is the way they would see it. Their gods were warrior leaders. Their gods could do amazing things. While we were in Greece, they would tell us that the Greeks had a story for everything. They talked about one of the gods who cut open his thigh and pulled out a baby and threw it out in the ocean, and that baby survived that and became strong and rose up and took on his father. Crazy stories. And that's where they got the pine tree from or something, you know. They had a story for everything. And they felt like they knew more than everybody. And Paul says, okay, I know Christ. And I know his message. And that was unexpected for them. They probably expected a big, long list of reasons why Jesus was the Son of God. They probably expected to hear some great oration as this letter was being read. Some debate techniques that were brought in that they would have been aware of to combat the wisdom of men. But he says, no, I need you to know something. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the disputer of this age? Where are these smart people? Where are they? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who are being saved. What they call foolishness can save us. What they call foolishness can bring about a great change in our lives. Verse 22, the Jews request a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. Remember I mentioned to you, the Greeks said they had a story for everything. They wanted to know everything. The Jews wanted a sign to prove that Jesus was the Son of God. They wanted him to bring a sign. They even asked him for one when he was here. And the Greeks, they didn't really care. They just wanted to find out anything they could find out and try to know something more than someone else. Verse 23, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks it's foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And so what the gist of this passage is, the idea is no matter how smart these folks who are challenging what he taught are, no matter how wise they seem to think themselves, no matter how much they felt like they had it all together, the power of God is in the message that he sent through Jesus. And some people are never going to understand that. Some people can never understand that. And I don't think he's saying this as a just leave them alone. We don't care about them. I think there's probably a little bit of sarcasm in here. There's probably a little bit of bite to what he's got to say. But knowing Paul the way we know him from reading other places, there was sorrow in his pen as he wrote this. Because remember, he's going to say later, I've become all things to all men that I might win some. He wanted to win them all, but he knew they couldn't. And so while he's bringing this seemingly confusing but interesting discussion about wisdom and the wisdom of men, and how the wisest man in the world is so beneath God, it's not even funny. The whole point of it is the power of God is in the message of the cross. And I'll be honest with you. I forgot that one time. I forgot that. I remember one time I was a student at Freed Hardeman. And I was a Bible major. Any Bible majors? Raise your hand if you're a Bible major. You know everything, don't you? I mean, when you're a Bible major at Freed Hardeman, you know everything. Just ask us. We'll tell you. We sit in Bible classes and we go back to our rooms and we have discussions and conversations. We know everything. We had gone to Thanksgiving dinner. My whole family comes together. It's my grandmother and all her siblings and all the everybody. It's everybody. We all go to Hatley, Mississippi. One time, one of my cousins had brought her boyfriend. And you could tell he was uncomfortable around us. And he had gone downstairs and found a black and white TV down there in the basement, was watching TV. And they were up there talking, and his name come up. Somebody asked where he was. They said, well, you know, he's not a member of the church. As a matter of fact, he's a member of the denomination, and we've talked to him. He said, really? He said, yeah. And they said, Reed, you're at Freed Hardeman. You're about, why don't you go down there and see if you can talk to him? Well, I was a Bible major at Freed Hardeman. So anything but a baptism was not going to work for me. So I walked down the steps and I sat down. I said, what are you watching? He said, I'm watching a football game. I said, good. I said, where are you from? And he told me. I said, do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? He said, yes. And I go, do you believe that you need to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins? He goes, no, I do not. And I said, well, you not believe Acts 2:38, Galatians 3:26, Acts 8, Acts 16, Acts 22? Do you not know what 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 21 says? Come on, what's wrong with you? There's only one baptism, Ephesians chapter 4. How are you missing this? And I stomped back up the stairs, and I remember saying, he won't listen. And I've cried over that day because I thought my wisdom was going to be what did it. I've literally shed tears over that day because I thought I was going to fix it. The power to change lives is not in you. The power to take away sins is not in you. That's the reason they were so confused when they brought the lame man and Jesus said, your sins are forgiven. Well, who can forgive sins? Well, I just wanted you to know that I could. Now, would you like for me to make him walk? Okay, why don't you stand up and walk? The power to save sins, the power to take away sins, the ability to put a person in heaven, that power is not in you, but it is in the gospel. And let me tell you what I want you to think about. First of all, I want you to know that arrogance and pride displace the power of God. The word displace means to move or put in an unusual order. It could even mean to take the place of. WD-40, water displacement 40. When you put it on, when you squirt it on something and it sprays on there, the water is displaced from there, unable to get in there. Sometimes you and I put too much power in ourselves and what we know. And arrogance and pride displaces the power of God. It removes it. It takes it out of the way. And we try to replace the power of the gospel with our wisdom and what we think we know. And sometimes we get some unexpected results because we think we know what everybody else needs to know. And we think we're the ones that need to tell them. And we think we need to do it in our way. And we fail because we think the power is in us. I remember I was umpiring baseball. It was one of my high school jobs. And I was a field umpire. And there was a little stocky guy. We're talking about 9, 10, I think it was 10, 11-year-old baseball. 11, 12-year-old baseball. There was a little guy, and he was stocky. He was real quick. His dad was just a little bit taller than him and stocky, and you could tell muscular fella too. This little guy was, you know, he was smaller, but you could tell that he had his physical ability to him. Well, there was a guy behind the plate who was on the other team. He was the catcher. And this guy who was on third base as a base runner, whenever the ball would go in, he'd get a big secondary lead. He'd take off down through there. He'd turn around and come back. He did that a time or two. Well, that catcher jumps up after the second or third time he did it. He jumped, looked at him and said, come on down here. I own home plate. I own home plate. He yelled it at him. Well, the guy kind of goes back to third base and gets down. They throw the next pitch. He takes the secondary lead. He jumps up and he goes, I said, come on down here. I own home plate. I own home plate. Come on, bring it down. Bring it on. Bring it on the next pitch. Here, come on. He got down, and I saw the third base coach whisper something into his son's ear. And as an umpire, I know what I was supposed to think. But as a guy watching that guy jump up and yell for him to come on, I know what I was thinking. Lay him out. And as soon as that pitcher let that ball go, that little guy went flying off down towards home. The batter got out of the way, and the owner of home plate stood right in front of it as a small train laid him on his back. He took himself out of the game crying. I know who owns home plate now. It's that little guy. You know, arrogance and pride can find us laying flat on our back. But the problem is, we want to glorify God. We want to glorify God. Glorification is to raise the opinion of. We want to raise the opinion of God. But we feel like it's in us. We feel like it's in that we have the power to do that. But when we let our arrogance and our pride get in the way, it displaces the power of God. Romans chapter 12 and verse 3. For I say through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. The next thing is doubt and excuses misplace the power of the gospel. You know, there may be those of us who arrogance and pride aren't a problem. There are humble people out there. You know, when we preach on humility, our assumption is that there's nobody humble in the audience. Well, that's not true. There's a lot of humble people in the audience. There's a lot of folks who have a good attitude. There's a lot of folks who have a correct perspective of themselves. They don't think too highly of themselves. They respect others and are respected because of that. But sometimes we feel like we don't have any way of helping people. And sometimes it's because we make an excuse to say, well, they're not going to listen anyway. There's no way they're not going to listen. I've known them for years. I've known them for a long time. They're not going to listen. I've talked to them about it before. Their parents have gone to that church for years. There's no way they're going to leave. Have you seen the way they act and what they say? They're never going to change. What if they ask me something and I don't know how to answer it? What if they bring up something I've never thought about before? Have you thought about how much we're going to have to actually teach this person to get them to where they need to be? I don't even know if their marriage is right. Before they can ever be active here as they are there, we've got to teach them about instrumental music. We've got to teach them about women's rights. We've got to teach them all this stuff. It's such a long process. And our doubt and our excuses misplace the power of the gospel. We pick it up. We pick the power of the gospel up and we put it over here. And we step in its place, and then we try to figure out how it's not going to work. Did you know, and have you ever thought about this, that Jesus established his church to always be successful? And Jesus allowed us to have truth, sent by the Holy Spirit through God, for it to be successful and change lives? God never intended for the gospel to fail. He never intended for the church to fail. Is it going to work every single time? No, we know that. But when we start having doubt in the gospel and we start making excuses, we misplace the power of the gospel. I believe Paul dealt with this when he dealt with his thorn in the flesh. We don't know what his thorn in the flesh is. We have some sort of idea. It could have been an eyesight problem. Could have been some emotional problems. Could have been a temptation. I've read a lot of things on it. The truth of the matter is, if they'd have wanted us to know, they'd have told us. We just need to know what we read in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. When he says, unless I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, unless I should think more highly of myself than I should, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, to discourage me, to give me doubt, to allow me to give excuses, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient. Watch the way the rest of this goes. My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in your weakness. That's unexpected. Paul didn't expect that. He says, therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. All the things that could bring me down and all the things that could be good excuses for me. For when I am weak, then I'm strong. It's unexpected. That's not the way Paul thought it was going to become. When he pleaded and pleaded with God to take away his excuse and his doubt, God said, you are putting too much emphasis on yourself. I can be strong and you be weak. And so the last thing I want you to know about the power and the unexpected idea of God, that is, humility with confidence replace the power of the gospel. It puts it in the right place. It puts it in a place where it belongs. You go back to 1 Corinthians, and you move forward from where we were to chapter 2. Remember, I told you when he showed up to Corinth, he had been run out of Thessalonica, he had been run out of Berea. He had already been in Philippi in chapter 16. He had been in prison, he had been beaten. He's down in Athens, and he's mentally challenged, and he's emotionally challenged, and he's wore out, and he goes across the sea, and he ends up in Corinth, and he stops for a little while. And this, when he's writing back to them, this is what he says. And I, brethren, when I came to you, okay? When I came to you in chapter 18 of the book of Acts, when I came to you, I did not come with the excellence of speech or the wisdom declaring to you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified, the message. I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. And my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. And so, later, when he writes back to the Romans, he can say, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God to salvation. Humility isn't weakness. Humility is understanding who we are and who we are not. And confidence does not equal arrogance. I can have confidence in the gospel of Christ and be humble all at the same time. And when I'm humble, but I have confidence in the power of the gospel, the message, the power is replaced where it belongs. That doesn't seem to make sense. Conventional wisdom would say the more powerful the preaching, the better the Christian. The more Bible verses they can quote, the stronger they are. The better they can debate, the louder they get, the more forceful they come across. Paul said, I didn't have anything smart to say to you. I was scared to death and I was wore out and I needed a break. But the church is alive and well and strong, not because of me, because of the power of the gospel. We're going to offer the Lord's invitation tonight. Maybe there's someone here tonight who's not been baptized for forgiveness of your sins. We'd love the opportunity to study you with you. Take your Bible in your hand and show you exactly what God promises and what He expects. And it's our hope that you'll find exactly what we have, that living the faithful life of the child of God is the best way to live this life. Maybe there's someone here who has been baptized, but you're falling away. Arrogance may be in the way. Pride may be in the way. Maybe it's doubt and excuses, and you would just like for us to pray with you that you may have humility and confidence. If we can help you in any way, please let us know as we stand and sing.